Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
You know, we've spent about £6 million building this so far at this point. So a member of Department for Education was with me and I took him into one school and they went to this girl in the corner of the room. And we'd been told by the teacher that this girl has slight social issues at school. So she struggles and she said, you know, what do you think about using this technology in your school? And the little girl turned around and said, you know, it's the first time in my life where I don't feel stupid. And I just thought that was worth £6 million.
You're listening to Women Tech Charge from the Evening Standard with me, Anne-Marie Maffedon. What happens when you mix education and artificial intelligence? Can technology ensure pupils are reaching their full potential? In this episode, I'm talking to a woman who's done exactly that. She's also given millions of meals to homeless people in India. Settle in, this is a good one. To be honest, they all are, so make sure you're subscribed. I'm sat here in the wild, wild west of London, joined by a woman who is innovating and helping the laggards in our education system and bringing them into the future. Her company, Century Tech, combines the best of our favourite buzzwords, AI, big data, data mining, to ensure that children reach their full potential. Say hello to Priya Lakhani, OBE, CEO of Century Tech.
If only I could be introduced this way every morning.
You can have this one for free.
That would be great. Thank you.
So I did a little bit of the intro there, Priya. Yep. What's the official elevator pitch?
Century is the platform that learns how every brain learns. And by learning how every brain learns, it can provide a completely individualized, differentiated path for every individual across any subject, any curriculum, any age group. And by doing that, it can help to improve outcomes. It also takes all of that data that it learns about an individual child, let's say, in school, and it provides it on instant dashboards to teachers. So if we think about education and where the real problems are on the front line, mm-hmm. you know, we've got a teacher standing up in front of a classroom of 30 children. Mm-hmm. And Anne-Marie, as you and I both know,
Behaviour managing
yes. is often an issue. Yep. But even when you get past that, what does every teacher actually want to do? What do they dream of doing when they sign up to teach? They want to differentiate for every child. They want to intervene mm-hmm. when necessary. Every child deserves a completely personalised education because mm-hmm. how we learn is as unique as our fingerprints.
They want to empower and inspire as well, right?
Exactly. And that's what they're supposed to be doing. Yeah. But isn't it fascinating how 60%, that's 60% of a teacher's time is spent on admin, micro-marking, micro-assessing, you know, trying to figure out what child needs what, marking homework, marking tests. Then they suddenly have to become data analysts because they have to figure out where all the gaps in knowledge are and how to plug those gaps.
The median, the average, and the rest of it, yeah.
Yeah, so Century's purpose is really to have so it's a learning platform where any child can go on and it uses artificial intelligence, machine learning, natural language processing to learn how they learn. It provides the child with a completely differentiated, personalised journey. It's constantly adapting. It learns their knowledge, their skills, gaps in knowledge and skills, focus levels, effort levels, memory function, etc.
Very, very long elevator pitch.
It is a long elevator pitch, but it's worthwhile saying because it's a complex product. And then it takes all of that data, but it provides its teachers so that micro-marking and micro-assessing disappears. And the reason I talk about it so much and I'm so passionate about it is because how is it so that this doesn't already exist? So we know that every sector in the world has been transformed by technology.
Mm.
And how has it been transformed? Well, it's more efficient. You know, we know how to search, we know how to shop, we can find our accommodation very, very quickly. We know how to invest and, you know, where to save our money. And yes, so it's about efficiency, but it's also about making better decisions. Mm-hmm. And we know that data in the right hands can be very powerful. So teachers should have the data and they should collect that data. They should have constant formative assessments. So we should have children, you know, being asked questions regularly to be able to test not just their knowledge, but their depth of knowledge and the skill sets that they can apply on top of that knowledge. But the problem is that collecting all of that data, then gathering it, then analysing it is incredibly time consuming.
Mm.
But once you've got it and you've analysed it, it's super powerful. So the question for me was very much, you know, can a machine do that and automate the unnecessary workload burden on teachers that they currently do manually? But then can it do the really important part, which is analyse the data and put that in a teacher's hands? So what I always say is, look, when we look at a classroom, the most important person in the classroom is a child.
Yep.
But the most powerful person in the classroom is the teacher.
Should be.
So that's who we need to empower with that analysis. And,
mm.
you know, we now have teachers all over the world that I have experience of, that use Sentry, where they make timely targeted interventions as and when necessary. And we've got parents...
kind of just pings and it's like, you know, tap Bob on the shoulder.
You can log in right now and in under 5 minutes, the machine will tell me, if I was your teacher or if I was your parent or guardian, because I would have a portal too as your parent or guardian, it would tell me exactly where you need to focus in maths, chemistry, physics, English, whatever age group, whatever course, instantly. So then I can support you with the learning. And if I do nothing, and let's assume I leave you on your own, it will learn why you don't understand something, not just if you're struggling. So if you're struggling in physics, it might learn that's because you're struggling to calculate equations in maths.
So does that mean
give
you
that
doing,
content.
Does that mean you're doing everything on the computer then?
So we see students spending about an hour to 2 hours a week on Sentry.
Right.
And it's augmentative because, I mean, we had this discussion offline just earlier, but, you know, can the machine do everything? The answer is no. It augments teaching, but it just cannot replace teachers. You're never going to be able to replace that one-to-one interaction that, you know, a child has with a teacher, and I don't expect it to do so.
The connection, we've not quite got the technology yet, have we?
Yeah, no, and you know, in a sense, well, why would we want to drive it in that sort of a way? Because we've got to remember what makes us human, what makes us special about being human, the empathy, you know, that we can show, the pastoral care that a teacher provides to a child, right? Sort of super teachers, you know, that those nuances in the curriculum that actually are very, very difficult to you know, to be able to code and codify. But so we don't want to replace that. But how can we use technology to solve big problems? And I think, you know, that's the key here, and that's why I founded Sentry. I wasn't a techie. I'm not a techie. I know now that my CV says...
You're not a techie, she says.
Well, I'm not, but, I've got a couple of now nano degrees in AI and neuroscience, and that sounds really bizarre, but it's not, because all of these... This education is available, a lot of it online,
exactly.
A lot of it for free. And so I upskilled myself. And actually, people are really afraid of that. And whenever I talk to them, I think, well, hang on a second, you love learning. We all love learning. We are born to learn. You know, we're on our phones, we're searching quicker, we're trying to find answers, we're using resources available to us. And I came at this problem, and this is where I think there's a huge opportunity for everyone to get involved in technology. And it's not scary if you come at it from a problem-oriented approach. And so, you know, coming at particular issues and thinking, well, how do I ensure that I'm working beyond the betterment of myself?
Mm-hmm.
How can I change the world for the better?
Mm.
Is there a way in which we can use certain technologies to actually apply those to these particular problems? I think that's really, really important. I'm just going to state a fact here because, I don't like to generalise, but statistically, there are more social impact startups and scale-ups led by women than there are by men.
Yep.
And so we have this huge disparity in terms of STEM education, and we talk about this a lot, and it is a real problem.
STEM for those who don't know.
Which is why you need to go to STEM Ed. But yeah, exactly, sorry. Science, technology, engineering and mathematics. Mm-hmm. And there's a huge gap in the market. There's a huge, you know, there's just a big hole when it comes to women, which we need for so many reasons.
There's a hole in the industry, which frustrates me, and it's the same thing you're saying, which is
there's a hole in education as well, though, right?
There's a
how
hole
many
in,
girls
in the education,
take up a STEM degree?
But how many people that don't have a STEM degree are also working in the industry, right? So it's one of those things where it's nice to have people have that training when they're younger, and I benefited from it, and you know, I wouldn't change it for anything. But also it's about everyone realizing that behind the Bitcoin, or behind insert name of insert buzzword here, it is about solving problems, and primarily about solving problems. And we need that almost as much as we need the technology itself, right? It's really important to be able to talk about the altruism and connect the two, because otherwise the technology means nothing. So the example I always love is, I did maths and computer science at university. Numbers was a big thing, I guess, as you'd assume, kind of on a maths degree course. And number theory was a big part. And we did so much on kind of the history of prime numbers, and the fact that this was 300 years ago that the Chinese were, you know, working through these prime numbers and working out the principles of them, and how you find them. And I remember being sitting there and thinking, you know, how crazy that was 300 years ago. None of those people that worked on that have any idea that that's literally what underpins all of our security and so many of the algorithms that we use today to make credit card transactions, to have the world go round. It's based off them toying with prime numbers, but how frustrating that it's 300 years later.
Yeah, and exactly. And these things do take time, but also, you know, related to that, but on the sort of whole, you know, if we look at all of these big sort of buzzword industries and look at how it applies to everybody, you know, every company is a technology company, I would argue now. Ultimately, every single one.
Yep.
And when we've got people, and we, you know, you made the really valid point about the fact that you don't have to have had that maths or computer science background. What's really interesting, and what I find now, is I always say to marketeers, for example, do you know that if you don't understand data, you're not going to get a great marketeering job? Because actually, now we want marketeers, but we want marketeers who understand ROI, return on investment. We need marketeers who understand data analysis.
Exactly.
So this is becoming really part and parcel of the skill set.
Of work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of the general skill set that is required of everybody. And so we do have this lack of females in technology in the sector, and those that potentially, you know, I'm not saying that everyone needs to be a techie at all. No. Not at all, because we need everything around that. You've got the people that code. You've got the people that understand logic, in a sense. And I rather talk about that because I think, you know, languages change, coding languages change. It's that ability to problem solve. It's that ability to, you know, use logic. It's about the ability to essentially apply a language to solve problems. It's about problem solving. But, you know, it applies in every single part of every sector, and every sort of job set will require it. And so we really need people to think, well, how can I use this? Or how can I learn about it? And what would be really, really great is obviously if we had people, you know, thinking, well, I want to do something about it, in a sense, taking ownership of their own education in that sense, because there are no fundamental changes to the curriculum that really allow, I think, our children to understand what sort of skills they're going to need in the future. I mean, I think our education system to date is really not fit for purpose.
There are no, or they're
very little.
Or it's impossible to. Because that my thing is, so computer science in particular is one where the technology industry is moving so quickly that trying to set a curriculum that doesn't become obsolete very quickly is nigh on impossible.
Yeah, if you wanted to set a curriculum, but the problem is that if there's an emphasis in a curriculum on teaching to a specific test at the end of the year, right?
Which is where we've ended up being.
Which is exactly. Then you have, you know, a real mismatch between what, you know, essentially schools are having to do because they, you know, they're measured
league
that way.
Tables and everything.
If you think, I mean, if we look at anything in any industry, not just schools, if we measure people a certain way, their behaviour will be driven towards achieving what they're measured by.
Yep.
And so it's really not about necessarily changing the curriculum or a specific part of the curriculum, because actually my view is that it is what it is. It doesn't really matter too much what it is, because I trust teachers. We all want the child to do well. There are 8.2 million.
There are
8.2 million pupils in this country. And what started me doing this was when I heard that 1.8 million of them were underperforming a few years ago. And I thought that's 20%. So how do we also do this and not at the expense of outcomes? So it's coming at that problem-oriented approach now. You know, this is the problem. How do we fix it? And so for me, it was very much, well, what tools are there out there, you know, to help? And when I was sitting on Vince Cable's advisory board when he was Secretary of State of Business, Innovation and Skills during the coalition government, this is what I was hearing. And at the time, as you know, I was running a food company.
Yeah, how do you even end up on that in that room running with Masala behind you?
So I was a barrister for a few years and loved it, and actually used to work for the press, and it was great fun. But I spent my entire childhood, you know, with summers and winters in East Africa, and I never got off the plane back into the UK and forgot about the poverty.
Okay.
I thought it was so unjust. And when I was very young, I just decided that the burden rested squarely on my six-year-old shoulders to change the world and give every child equal opportunity when it came to nutrition, healthcare and education.
I felt
and
the same way when I was six.
Yeah, there we go. So we've got lots in common. And so and so I was, you know, I spent my whole childhood basically raising money for charities, and my parents used to just think it was really bizarre. So it was all I wanted to do. And then I thought that the most just career to obviously go into would then be law, because if we're thinking about equity and justice,
defending,
you think law.
Yep.
Right. And so I thought actually my main job is, I actually wanted to go into the press and make editorial and investigative journalism fair and more positive, because I used to read the papers a lot when I was a kid. I was quite interested in current affairs. And I used to think, I wonder how we could create a bit of balance, et cetera, and how I could help. And then doing that for a few years, still, I loved it. And, you know, if I ever retire, I'd do that for free. I really did enjoy it. But I didn't feel like I was moving the dial as much as I thought I did.
Right.
And so I sort of noticed that actually, you know, it's very much up to the editors, and it depends on which papers you're working in, et cetera, et cetera. So I'd come up with this idea. There was a gap in the market in food for fresh ethnic sources. And I thought, I'll solve the problem. I'll start my own company. Sort of a long story about that. But I started Masala Masala. And with Masala Masala, it was my big opportunity to try and change the world. So I know it sounds bizarre, I'm selling curry sauces, but for every pot of sauce that I sold, I fed a homeless person a hot meal. We provided the pentavalent 5-in-1 vaccine to children in Africa, and we started building schools. 1 year in, after 1 million meals served, about 9 schools funded, and about 35,000 vaccines provided, that got on the radar of government. And then Vince Cable asked me to be on his advisory board.
As a social entrepreneur.
It was really actually with business innovation skills, I think it was more the startup scale-up entrepreneur. It was very much about the business side. But what was fascinating about the way the government was structured at that point, and I think it still works this way, is that business innovation and skills, now it's BEIS, obviously, so you've got the energy part of it, but they were interested in skills, because obviously that affects the economy. If we haven't got people in the workforce in certain jobs and creating jobs, it affects GDP, et cetera, et cetera. So they were fascinated about skills. There's one board meeting. We had Matthew Hancock, who is now our Secretary of State for Health, in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a lot of time for that man, because I have to understand, you know, having spent a lot of time with people in government and talking to them, he really does understand technology. He understands how disruptive it is, how disruptive it can be. And he came into the room and started the conversation about, look, why aren't we solving these problems using technology? And I thought, well, why aren't we? And so I went away and did some research. And interestingly, Vince Cable was also a huge advocate of, we need to help solve this. You know, we now had two people who, you know, it wasn't really their direct job, but they were thinking, because we were in a BEIS meeting, you know, it seemed like education was very much Department for Education's you know, remit.
Not business.
No, exactly. But they were thinking, well, actually, no, it's a hybrid approach. It was really interesting. It was a very interesting time. And they said, how can we help? And so when I said, well, look, I want to go and do some research, Vince Cable supported me. He said, you know, you know, what do you need? And I said, well, I'd like one of your special advisors to help me with some research. He did do that. I went away. I went to schools all over the country, the best performing schools in the country, some of the schools that were, you know, slightly more challenged in terms of their performance. And I saw the same problems. It didn't matter which school I was in. In every school, there is a bell curve. Mm-hmm. There are children that are struggling and left behind in every classroom. Mm-hmm. There are children who are under-challenged and need a bit more stretch. And every teacher in any given moment in the classroom is faced with that problem.
Yep.
And when you're looking at it, you're thinking, well, what's the teacher going to do?
Mm.
And what's really interesting is, they deliver a one-size-fits-all delivery, sort of, you know, educate. That's what they do.
Yeah.
They deliver the lecture.
And the system works.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. And they're forced to do it. And then what I was really ashamed of, was that in the summer, because I spent quite a lot of time researching this, we went through the summer holidays. At this point, I have a two-year-old child. You know, I was pregnant with my son. So I was also very interested in education from a parental, a maternal aspect.
Mm-hmm.
But I then looked at the media, and when schools didn't quite perform how they expected to, or a child didn't perform how the parent expected them to, what I saw was that some schools were dragged through the mud. You know, they didn't perform. This was what's wrong with the school, et cetera, et cetera, particularly in local media. And I looked at that and thought, I have now met hundreds of teachers, and I have never met a teacher who came to teach badly.
Right, okay.
Because they don't do it for the money.
Yeah.
That's the interesting thing about the profession.
Mm.
And they're not respected at all. They constantly have to battle with a lot of problems. And I saw these problems. I thought, well, we need to solve these problems.
Mm.
And we need to solve it for the children and for the teachers. And
for
so,
ourselves.
Yeah, you know, how do you do that? Well, you start thinking, well, what does exist? And what was very striking was that in every classroom, I saw that in terms of technology, we'd gone from a blackboard to a whiteboard, and that was about it. But, you know, at the same time, I'm pulling out my smartphone and I'm able to order a taxi online. I'm able to, you know, book accommodation. I'm able to search really fast. But there was no artificial intelligence and neuroscience platform in education. There were several reasons why not. I know one is the very, you know, it's the typical argument you hear where you say, well, schools are risk averse. They take a long time to adopt technology. They do, but their stakeholder is really important. You know, they're not just concerned about revenue like most companies. They have to look after children.
Other performance. So I
can understand that, and I appreciate that. But also, we mustn't forget that in order to build an artificially intelligent platform that uses neuroscience in the way that we've done, costs millions and millions of pounds. Mm-hmm. So investors have to think, where do I want, you know, that requires investment. And so one of the other problems is investors look at it and think, well, would I rather put my money in a fintech company, which might sell for X amount of pounds and, you know, I might get 8 to 20 times my money in 3 years? Or would I rather invest in building an edtech company where I have to be incredibly patient? And so what happens is there's a gap there as well. So all of these issues result in why the sector has been very late to be able to adopt technology. But what I must say right now is that I've been doing it for 5 years and it is growing. We are growing at such a fast pace. So I think now...
We said fintech, I was going to... You know, yeah. Fintech meaning financial technology company.
Sorry, I'm using all the lingo here, which is terrible.
But no, I was going to say, edtech is, it has become or is becoming its thing. Like there's quite a lot of, there's edtech podcasts, edtech festivals, there's, you know, BET has been there since before edtech.
BET's been there a long time.
Yeah, and BET, I remember when BET was Becta, and BET is like this kind of big edtech... Gosh, all the letters. This big edtech event that happens in January in London, and then they do the education show in Birmingham, normally in March time.
They
I think.
Well, there's a lot. I mean, yeah, there's them. There's Katie Fryer. It's this amazing lady who's created her own.
I do Learn It. Yeah,
Learn
yeah,
It. Katie, so Learn It is coming up now, which is a new one. And she's very teacher focused and educator focused, which is quite nice, actually, because she's really taken it from the angle about what do they care about.
Yeah.
But there's quite a lot. It is an industry in itself. There's no doubt about that. But what I'm now seeing is the adoption's happening. So that curve that we mentioned in the beginning, where we said, you know, there's an adoption curve to technology. There's not adoption curve to anything new. And we have the innovators and the pioneers at the beginning. Then we have sort of the early adopters. And then, you know, what we call sort of the laggards at the end. And the innovators and the pioneers have already adopted Century. So I've seen that globally. So, you know, we're in many countries and they've taken it on. They've tested it. For the last few years, they've got improvement of outcomes of over 30% across the board. What I really love about it is not just that. That sounds like a really great stat, but it's not that for me. It's the fact that economically disadvantaged children perform just as well as their peers on Century.
Wow.
Why is that? Because artificial intelligence doesn't care where you're from.
Yep.
It will figure out a way.
Good AI doesn't.
Good AI doesn't.
Yes.
Yeah. And also, you know, with a diverse tech team where we've got women, with female data scientists, female engineers, you also, you know, you can try and ensure that you haven't got that algorithm bias that is a big issue that people talk about.
And data bias as well across schools that you're working with. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, and, you know, having co-founded the Institute of Ethical AI for Education with Sir Anthony Seldon and Professor Rose Luckin from the Institute of Education at UCL, you know, we're really looking into how do you build and scale this technology in an ethical way that always ensures it's AI for good. And I think that if listeners could think about these problems that they come across, well, it doesn't have to be in education, it can be anywhere, and think, how could we also apply new tools and technology in an ethical way to make, so, you know, that would just be such a wonderful thing. And I think that it's often the non-traditional techies that can come up with these ideas because they're looking at things from a very open point of view.
Yeah, you almost need to be the outsider, right? There's a lot of things that kind of are less obvious for you if it's not something you've grown up with or you've trained in. If you're not classically trained, is the thing I always like to say, then it means that you're looking at it.
Well,
from
you're also in the field, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the fact is, I wasn't completely new to education because when I was a barrister, I taught for 2 years. I taught postgraduate students in the evening. I taught media law, and so I knew, in a sense, you know, what does teaching involve, right? You know, how marking, assessing, all these things, you know, and it's really interesting how people still think that to be a teacher is great because you have really long summer holidays and you leave at 3:30. And I just think that is not true at all. My teachers...
To talk to a teacher.
Yeah, and my teachers will happily tell you their workload.
Watch Waterloo Road.
Yeah, exactly. But what's really fascinating is that, you know, at Century as well, we save workload by a day a week. And so if you can imagine giving every teacher a day back, and what's, you know, what I cannot get over is the fact that we, in fact, there's a publication out there that surveyed a lot of our teachers that wrote an article on this. And they said, we surveyed the teachers and what do they do with their day a week? Not one of them said, I go to the pub. Like, you know, I get home early. No, they spend more time on targeted, timely interventions with children and pastoral care. Mm-hmm. And so what's really fascinating about the sector is that we have this workforce of incredible people who really, really want to change their world, change the world in their own way. Mm-hmm. And we need to help them. You know, we need to ensure, we need to empower them. We need to ensure, and they're helping, you know, at the end of the day, they're looking after our children. Mm. These are the guardians of our children when we're out, when we're at work. And so we really need to treat them with the most amount of respect. And so, and there is a really great way to do this, which I am going to say, because I think it's really important, but any listeners who are parents, nominate your teacher to the Teaching Awards. There's something called the Thank a Teacher campaign. Can you believe? And I have to just a slight wave here, and you know, in terms of bias, I am on their board, right? But the thing is, can you imagine that if you nominate a teacher for Thank a Teacher, it's a Thank a Teacher campaign, they actually write a handwritten card to your teacher and send it to them.
What is a handwritten card? I've not heard of one of those before.
I know, it's not. Anne-Marie, let's go back a little bit, maybe about 2 decades. Do you remember when people used to write? You know, pen?
Had a pen, right,
ink.
Okay.
Yeah, I see. There are machines that do this as well, so you might be aware of those. So this time you use your fingers, and you know those fine motor skills in your hand?
Completely
lost them. Really important skills.
I'm at a keyboard all the time.
Well, this is one of the reasons why also I have to be, again, very honest and say that when Century goes into schools, we do say, look, you know, of course, we've got kids on it for 6-8 hours a week sometimes, and they get quite obsessive over it, particularly some children with special needs love going on the platform. But we say, look, at an hour a week, 2 hours a week is absolutely maximum. In primary, we have, you know, within 20, 30 minutes a week on this system, the platform will learn everything about the child in terms of how they learn and then give that data.
That's very quick.
Which is amazing.
Yeah.
But we say, look, don't use it all the time. And it's not necessarily the screen time debate I'm getting into here, it's the fine motor skills debate. So with primary age children, we don't want them to constantly be tapping screens all day, because those muscles in between the thumb and the forefinger are actually really, really important.
Four.
You know that thing that you don't like to do,
which writing. Is,
well, it's not just writing, picking.
I've heard people say this though. So, because when I was little, we used to have, I was gutted because my handwriting is
still
shoddy.
Can we take a picture
now.
Of her right now, by the way? She's got a pen in her hand.
I have a pen in my hand.
She's got a pen in her hand
but
right now.
But I haven't used it. It's like the comfort. It's to practice these two muscles you said were really important. But we had like handwriting licenses that we had to do, and I was like the last person to get it in
that's
my
life. That's okay.
Well, but it's really funny because now, so there are, I've spoken to people who've been like, you know, kids, well, that's not a future skill.
Yeah, well, there is a country that's taken out handwriting at the curriculum. But what we'll do is,
then you've got to think, like, will we evolve then? You'll end up with like a webbed hand or something. Do you think that's going to be like a thing that will change?
I don't know. I'm going to get a box of Cheerios and drop them on the floor and then see if I can pick them up faster.
No, that's that game.
I'll pick them up.
You know that game where you have to do it with no hands?
Do you know what you'll do though? And I know what she'll do. She will go, Anne-Marie, you will go and get
a robot.
That robot vacuum cleaner and just say, go and pick it up.
Yep. We'll do that. Definitely. Know me too well. Or I play it as a game.
Surgeons.
Like
what about surgeons?
Like a game. What
do
about
you
them?
Do you want every robot doing surgery? No, because I know robots do surgery, but do you want every surgeon doing surgery properly, or do you want surgeons to have? I'm just saying that the muscle's important.
Did you know they did surgery on a grape? That's like a meme, by the way. Yeah, sorry, I had to put that in there. But that wasn't a human being, that was a robot that did it. My professor, coincidentally, he's like a robotics person from my university, and we were talking about the fact that the ethics in that is still, we're still nowhere near working out whether that should be something we allow robots to do, because there are certain parts of surgery, so like stitches at the end, that are quite repetitive movements. So you probably could give a bot that to do, but then you have to then work out all the legalities of it all have got in the way of that technology allowed to be being widespread.
So every year I do something really exciting, and I go to Silicon Valley and I see what's going on behind the scenes there, just to know that, I know it's not globally, it's just the West, you know, it's here and there, but I can sort of see advances in technology. And I was speaking to some incredible disruptors, you know, and their surgeons who then created tech companies. And, you know, they sort of say, well, look, the thing is, nobody is, just like how we learn is unique, nobody is exactly the same.
Yeah.
And so to be able to program some things, sometimes deal with the nuances and you know, what you might be faced with in actually a very high pressure situation.
Yeah, it's tough.
It's really challenging. Yeah. And so I think there are some areas where
stitches was
they
what
can
we
help.
Were talking about specifically.
Yeah, stitches, that could be a real issue. I think and there are some areas where, you know, robotics are already being used that could be great. But I think this is, again, you know, this is where people can have a say about these things. They can have a debate about these things. They can think about, you know, when we've got something that's, when we're training artificial intelligence, you know, who's training it, who's actually holding the reins behind that. And with ethics, that's really important as well. Like who's chosen those training sets of data? Who's trained them? Who's weighted the algorithms one way or another? Mm. You can talk about it with surgery and stitches. You can talk about it with driverless cars. Yeah. You can talk about it with education technology.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think people, once they're starting to talk about and question these things and learn about them, that will be a really great day when everyone understands how to debate these issues.
I can't wait for that day.
Yeah.
I think so. For me, and you'll be the same, there's so many of these boards, so many of these committees, so many of these kind of closed door situations going on where we're deciding policies and we're kind of influencing. And I'm not an evil person. If I was an evil genius, then, you know, God forbid. But I think there's so much where if you look at something like, I say this all the time, look at something like immigration.
Yeah.
Everyone has an opinion on immigration. We're not all immigration lawyers, but it is something that you can kind of prop up and have a conversation about. And I can't wait for the day where even just the use of AI just in our public systems would be something that people come out and say, you know, actually, I'm making an informed decision to say I'd rather not have that make
and,
it.
And don't you think that once we have that, there'll just be so much more transparency because it's demanded?
Yeah.
So, you know, a revolution always happens essentially when consumers demand a certain change.
Yeah.
They demand things a certain
or
way.
Or when the EU decide to do GDPR.
But yeah, but how can you demand a certain thing unless you know about it?
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
What has been the hardest bit of your transition of going from, I'm going to call you a techie, from non-techie entrepreneur to techie entrepreneur?
That's interesting because that's sort of...
Or non-techie to techie.
Yeah, that's interesting because that's sort of a question from the bridge between when I ran a company, but it was fast-moving consumer goods, FMCG, to tech. The transition, that's a really good question. I mean, culturally, it's a little bit different.
Okay.
You know, having a large engineering team and learning that actually, I think sometimes the team looks at the market as a whole and looks at those lovely stories, you know, from Facebook about free lunches and unlimited holidays and sort of think, well, where are our free lunches and our unlimited holidays? And actually the transition's not,
Where are they?
Yeah, where are they? Well, let me tell you something now. There is no such thing as a free lunch, Anne-Marie. And if you haven't heard that one before, and unlimited holidays are not what they seem. On average in the USA...
No one takes them.
Yeah,
but on average... But that's because they don't take holidays anyway.
On average in the USA, they actually take less holidays when you give them unlimited holidays because people feel bad about taking them.
But here we take them. Brits love a good holiday. I've got a friend who just transferred to the New York office of her company.
Do they give her 10 days instead of 25?
They gave her 10 days, but she takes the 10 days.
Yeah.
Everyone in the office is like, what are you, why are you always out? And she's like, we have 10 days of holiday.
Which is crazy, right? Because we give 25 plus 3 over Christmas in the year plus your birthday.
Yeah.
And so that's quite nice. But No, I think the transition was more actually my mindset of being a lawyer.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. To anything in business. Uh-huh. Because my mindset of being a lawyer is, look, you know, there is a very traditional way in which lawyers are trained.
Mm.
It's the same for sort of lawyers, bankers, consultants. There's this sort of, you know, get in early, leave really late. If you leave early, you might get
professional services.
It's just
vibes.
Yeah, you just, it's a vibe and the culture, which isn't a great one. And you know, we know that actually we're not very productive when we do that. Mm-hmm. But it's a mindset, and it's this looking like you're working really hard. And obviously, I'm telling you right now that I did work really hard. There wasn't a second where I wasn't. Exactly. But the point is, you know, then I moved into this tech industry. And I ran my first company very much like, a little bit like when I was a lawyer, because it's an industry that can cope with that. In tech, it's very different. You know, we sort of have people rolling in at 10:30 in the morning. But what's really interesting is that they're the ones who are coding at night or on the weekends. And it was developing that culture and understanding culture. So I did a lot of work on culture. I did a bunch of courses on culture.
Personally.
I did them myself.
Yeah.
And many. Mm. I've read lots of books on it. I've spoken to a lot of founders about it. I've been out to different companies here and in the US and in the East and talked and learned about culture. I've done all the personality sort of, not personality, but behavioural profiling tests. I've actually become trained on how to do them myself and deliver them.
Wow, you went in.
When I, this is a problem with me. When I go in 100%. It's all or nothing. Mm. I don't like sort of kind of knowing something. I like to master it or not.
Yeah.
And so I'd rather just not, because then I can't talk about it. I'm just like, why would I do that?
Mm.
And so actually I've gone into other companies and trained them on culture and building a really important culture. And it is really important. And if you have a culture that's misaligned with your strategy, it's a recipe for disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And so learning a new culture for tech and being a techie versus the old traditional professional services culture was a real transition and a learning curve. And I think we've done really well at Century. I mean, I think everyone's
so good.
Yeah, the sort of only way I can put it is that everyone we've sort of wanted to keep is there. So it's not really bad. But the thing is that, you know, the only people who've otherwise left have moved country. Okay. Interestingly. And that's not because they want to get really far away from us. That's because they genuinely want to move country. Yeah, exactly. And but I think it's a very happy place to work. We have, I'm not allowed to swear here, I'm sure, but we have a no arsehole rule on everyone's contract. It's on the front of their contract. It's
have the swear word in their contracts.
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
It's serious. Yeah. I mean it.
Cover your ears. Spoiler alert. Cover your ears if you don't hear it.
Yeah, that was too late, Anne-Marie. A robot would have done that quicker. It would have been able to see.
We'll put it in the edit. They won't.
Yeah. And so we have a no arsehole rule at work. We have, in part, on your contract, it says always do the right thing and try and do it kindly.
Yeah.
You know, and so, and we take that really, really seriously. And because we've asked people to leave because they've breached that before, it's taken very seriously at Century.
So you administer it. Who's another person you'd say you admire? / who are your mentors, I guess?
Oh,
I'm guessing you admire your mentors. I mean, let me know if you don't.
You can see my face is cringing because I'm going to give you an answer that you're probably not quite used to. Okay, so who do I
also... Is it your mum? Are you going to say your mum?
I love my mum. She's my best friend.
Okay, cool.
When I married my husband, he just said to me, I know I'm number two. And I was like, yeah, sorry. You are. I love you to bits, but you are number two. But then I also like some singers. Like I, you know, do you know the song from, is it Mika or Micah? And it's...
Mika.
And it's, you know, the song from Mika, and he goes really high-pitched. And it's Grace Kelly. Right.
Okay.
What's really interesting about how he wrote that song and why he wrote it, he was being rejected by absolutely everybody. And they were saying, you know, you're not going to be signed by our label because you're too tall. You're not signed by our label because you're too this, you're too high pitched, whatever. So he went home and said, I could be purple, I could be blue, I could be whatever.
Yeah.
Why don't you like me? Why don't you like me? Yeah. And so I heard his story and I now listen to that song every single day. Every day I listen to his song on the tube to work at least once, because he inspires me, because he wrote the song and look, it became a number one hit, you know, across the world. I love it. I've got the backing track now. So people, I think anyone who's got a story and they may not even be very well known inspires me. Mentors was the other question that you asked me.
Sorry, I filled it all into one bumper.
No, I like the question, because what I'd like to say to you is that mentees should pick their mentors as carefully as mentors pick their mentees. And
okay.
In my experience, that doesn't happen.
Right.
Right. People say, I need a mentor, because there's a lot on mentoring.
Yeah.
And I understand the importance of it. But then what I often find is that people then just sort of match a mentor to a mentee. And I always think, well, hang on a second. Not every mentor is the right mentor for that particular individual. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that myself. And I've just thought, I've had mentors given to me without me really being, you know, asking for it, or people that feel that they can coach me. And
can I just say that winds, that does annoy me.
It winds me up to know, because I just think, well, hang on a second, I didn't ask for it. And also, you know, particularly if it's someone who's mansplaining me or, you know, interfering. And I just think this is always a two-way relationship. And so actually I don't like mentorships and mentoring
that are allocated.
That are unallocated.
Yeah.
And forced, and also where the mentee can't see the value that the mentor might be able to provide them with. And I know that I'm preempting the fact that, look, I know that you get value that you don't often think that you would have had. That I understand.
Serendipity and all the rest
of it. That's serendipity. Yeah. But the thing is, I don't like it when it's forced. And I remember being given people, and I just remember sitting with them thinking, this is. I'm trying not to sound like really arrogant and impolite, whatever, but this is the biggest waste of my time.
No, it's not. It's less. It's more like you can only, the person can only mentor you well if you're ready to listen to them and if you respect them in some way.
And if you have
context on it.
It's, well, I would say that actually you've got to be ready to listen. So there's a guy called Stephen Eason who was the managing director of Waitrose at one point who mentored me. I asked for him to mentor me. He mentored me for years when I ran my first company, and he was incredible. And I learned so much from him. My board right now and my investors are my main, in inverted commas, mentors, because I go to them with questions. So, for example, there's one of my mentors. He's a really good friend of mine, actually, but I consider him a mentor in this capacity, is that I had some issues with parts of the business model, and I went to John Buss, who is now CEO of Yext. I went to Guy Fernando, who's co-founder of Freeformers. And Guy and John are both investors in Century, and I went to them. They are my friends, but I went to them specifically with that, no, can you put that hat on of helping me and mentoring? Yeah. Because you've done this before.
Yeah.
And they were incredible. Mm. But I think that that's really important, because I also knew what my ask was, and I was very clear. So I was really willing to sit down and say, right, just sort of feed me with all that knowledge. I want to learn about it. And so the key here is find out the needs of the mentee. What is it that they're struggling with? And it doesn't have to be a business need. It could even be an emotional need. It could be one thing that I think is really important is mindset. You know, it could be they haven't got confidence in X, Y, and Z, whatever. And then find somebody appropriate to be able to help with that specific need.
On that journey.
Yeah, and that's the thing about mentors that I think is really important and is not said often enough.
My final question. What's your favourite spice / which spice do you think is most underrated? So I bought a pestle and mortar a couple of months ago, and I've been looking through recipes, and I'm
I don't know what you classify it as, but you know turmeric has got healing properties. So my mum's answer...
Only if you use it with black pepper, though.
No, they just, you know, when I used to cut myself at school, my mum, so normal kids would have a plaster with
or
a
that
Disney
paper towel
character.
With water.
No, she would just rub turmeric all over it.
Didn't that hurt?
No, it doesn't hurt, because it doesn't hurt at all. But turmeric is staining. So then for the next few weeks, I would have like a yellow arm.
Yeah.
And I'd say, Mum, why'd you do that? So in terms of the spice that's underrated, I would say...
Turmeric, really?
No, I would say the spice that's underrated is cumin. Because if you can't buy proper at-strength cumin seeds, you can't make a really good curry.
Okay.
And one of the reasons why that business was so great and did so well so quickly was because we used to use really strong spices. If you went to the local supermarket and just bought... And also, if you don't roast them properly, or if you don't fry them properly, you fry them too long so they burn, or too little so they don't, for example, pop or crackle... then you're not going to get the flavour out of them. And that's why chicken curry doesn't taste good when someone doesn't know how to do it.
Do you fry cumin or you roast cumin?
Both. Fry it on there in the curry. And fry, yeah.
But then you don't put it in the pestle mortar after you've done that, do you?
No.
No. So it's
just put them in whole. Yeah. I could make a curry for you. Next time, we can have a curry.
I think it's actually quite rude you turned up today without a curry. Just saying.
I think it's really rude that you're holding a pen.
We're even. Thanks very much, Priya.
Thanks
for listening. Thanks for coming.
Thank you so much
I
for
really
having me, Anne-Marie.
I
loved
it.
And apologies for all the giggling in the background, but we're having a good time.
No, we like a good giggle. We like to have a laugh. Priya Lakhani is using artificial intelligence to give parents and teachers better data on pupils' performance, which they can actually use in between parents' evenings. Also, turmeric is her favourite spice, and you should listen to Grace Kelly by Mika every morning like she does.
You can follow her on Twitter at Priya Lakhani or on Instagram at PriLakhani1. You can check the spelling on that in the episode notes. Find out more about Century Tech by going on Twitter at This Is Century or Instagram Century Tech Learning. All that's left for you to do is subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts. It would also really help us if you rate and review it too. I and Marie live on Twitter at AEMAPHEDON, good luck spelling that, and on Instagram at NotYourAverageAMI, which is a little bit easier to spell. Get in touch, have a chat, ask questions using the hashtag WomenTechCharge.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.